You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's estimated that more than 35 million heart-shaped boxes of chocolate will be sold for Valentine's Day this year. And with less than a week until the big day, we thought we would look into chocolate for this week's Please Explain. Joining me now are Clay Gordon, who calls himself a chocolate critic. His website is chocophile.com. And Dr. Ann E. Kelly, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm very pleased to welcome them both to this week's Please Explain. Hi.
Hello.
Glad to be here today, Leonard.
Clay, why do we give chocolate at for certain celebrations like Valentine's Day and some others, I guess, Easter, Christmas, but not all the holidays? Is there a certain significance to chocolate for the holidays that we give it on?
Well, certainly with respect to Valentine's Day, chocolate has had since antiquity a connection with love. I mean, the Emperor Montezuma is purported to have drunk 50 goblets of chocolate every day in order to be able to service his harem. Those in the audience who've read the memoirs of the Marquis de Sade, and we're not going to ask them to call in and raise their hands and identify themselves, Casanova have all, so major literary and historical figures have all used chocolate as a part of their libidinous arsenal. And so I believe that's where the connection first started, certainly.
Dr. Kelly, is there any proof that chocolate is an aphrodisiac?
Actually, no. There's been a couple of studies looking at that, and while chocolate has quite power, can have quite strong effects on emotions in general, and we can talk more about that, there's no evidence specifically that chocolate can act as a powerful aphrodisiac like some other drugs.
Before we look at the physical impact of chocolate on our bodies, Clay, can you walk us through the process of making chocolate?
Absolutely. The cacao tree, is grown in tropical climates, plus or minus 20 degrees of the equator around the world. The cocoa seeds are actually harvested from a pod, which can be bright yellow to green to magenta, very, very colorful. The seeds are stripped from the pod, and then they are fermented. And it is during the fermentation process that proteins are converted into amino acids, complex sugars are converted into simple sugars, and then are made available for the roasting process.
Fermented in what?
Fermented in their own pulp. The seed is covered with actually a very, very tasty pulp, which is probably how humans discovered the cocoa pod, the cacao pod, because they would have seen animals break open the pod and suck the pulp off the seeds.
And the humans discovered them in Mesoamerica. But now I don't think of Mexico and Central America as a major supplier of cocoa. What happened?
The Spanish came and conquered Central America and took it back to the old world. I believe that one of the reasons why most of the cacao is grown in Europe is actually a part of colonialization. Using the colonies that were in West Africa and closer than the New World and being able to grow, and also as a result of agrarian land reform in the 1800s. I mean, the cocoa economy of Ecuador used to be the largest cocoa producer in the world in the 1800s. It fell apart after agrarian land reform and the farmers were given small plots.
But in Mesoamerica, it was only drunk. So somewhere along the line, somebody figured out that you could make a solid thing out of the chocolate.
Well, yes, the beans were always ground and sugar was added and it would have been made into lumps, and those lumps would have then been grated or somehow incorporated into a beverage. But it wasn't really until the 1840s in England, as a matter of fact, that we would have first started recognizing the first true eating chocolate.
There are three main kinds of cocoa beans. Can somebody with a sophisticated palate tell which ones are in a bar of chocolate?
It's very, very difficult, unaided, to be able to taste a bar of chocolate and say, this is a 100% Forastero variety chocolate, or this is a 100% Criollo variety. Somebody who is actually in the business of tasting chocolate on a daily basis or manufacturing chocolate has a much better job than the average person on the street. And most chocolate is made from a blend of cocoa beans from around the world. And so it's very, very rare to find a bar of chocolate which contains just one type of bean.
What part of the chocolate making process determines the quality? How does Hershey's chocolate differ in the way it's made or in the beans that it uses from Godiva or Jacques Torres or any other high-quality manufacturer?
It's all along the way. Higher quality chocolate is really determined by paying attention to detail and spending the amount of time necessary to do the process right. So fermentation is actually dependent upon the amount of time spent in fermentation is dependent upon the type of bean that you are fermenting. And if you under-ferment it, you don't develop all of the compounds necessary for roasting and flavor development. And if you over-ferment, you actually generate rotten flavors. If you don't dry it properly, you don't get the flavor development out of the drying process. If you don't roast properly, if you don't grind and then refine and conch properly, you also shortcut the flavor development of the bean. So
conch?
Conch. Yes, conch is actually a machine which was developed by Rudolf Lindt in the 1870s, and it's the final stage in the chocolate manufacturing process. So you take the ground-up cocoa liquor to which perhaps milk and sugar and other flavorings have been added, vanilla certainly, and you put it into a machine whose job basically it is to knead the molten chocolate for a period of time. And during that time, the cocoa powder particles are covered with cocoa butter. If there are any clumps of particles, they're broken up. And then if there's any water, it evaporates out. And any harsh acids like acetic acid left over from the fermentation process, those also evaporate off. So it wasn't until literally 1879 that what we today would recognize as eating chocolate was invented.
Don't all the things that they add in kind of adulterate the ultimate product? If you put milk in, if you put sugar in, the milk makes for a lighter milk chocolate. Mm-hmm. Doesn't taste as much like chocolate, does it? Are dark chocolates closer to the real thing, and is there a difference between dark chocolate and bittersweet chocolate?
Well, the more stuff you add to chocolate, the further away you get from the taste of just chocolate. Very few people feel comfortable eating a chocolate bar which contains only cocoa, 100% cocoa bar, a chocolate bar. They're an acquired taste. I happen to like it, but only in very, very small amounts, right? Which is how people prefer it. So sugar is added in order to be able to make the chocolate palatable to begin with. Now, it turns out that there's no definition for dark chocolate. I mean, according to the USDA standards of identity for chocolate, there's this thing called sweet chocolate, which covers both semi-sweet chocolate and bittersweet chocolate. But there's no legal distinction between the two of them. Sort of colloquially, dark chocolate is any chocolate that doesn't contain milk protein. So I can have a chocolate which contains butterfat or milk fat, and it's still technically a dark chocolate because it doesn't contain any milk protein.
My guests are Clay Gordon, whose website is chocophile.com, and Dr. Anne E. Kelly, professor of psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. When you have studied chocolate, Dr. Kelly, has the effect of it on our bodies been different depending on whether it was milk chocolate or dark chocolate, whether there was more sugar in it or less?
Right. Well, those specific experiments haven't been done, but I can tell you that the added ingredients of sugar, more sugar and more fat to chocolate just compounds the already endogenous ingredients, which are psychoactive in chocolate, such as the main one being theobromine, which is a stimulant in the methylxanthine class of drugs, similar to caffeine, for example.
Isn't there also caffeine in chocolate?
Yes, there's a little bit of caffeine, a lot less than the theobromine. There's also, interestingly, anandamide in chocolate. Now, what is anandamide? Well, that's a compound which is similar to THC, the active ingredient in marijuana. There's also a little tryptophan thrown in, which can activate the serotonin system in the brain. A little bit of phenylethylamine, which is also a stimulant. So you have all that already in chocolate, which can have measurable, generally activating and positively rewarding effects on the brain. But in answer to your question, you throw in a little fat and sugar, which I study in my lab and how that affects the brain in rats, and it's a very powerful, rewarding sensory experience.
Now, you said most of the things you've described are stimulants, but you also mentioned tryptophan, mm-hmm. which, as I I think I seem to remember is also in turkey, and it's the reason we get a lethargic feeling from eating turkey. So does that counteract all the stimulants?
No, I don't think it would counteract, and that's in a relatively small amount. The studies that have been done mostly that can really detect mood effects or cognitive effects of chocolate really focus on the theobromine primarily and the caffeine together.
So if I were to have a cup of hot chocolate before I went to bed, would that keep me awake the same way that a cup of coffee might?
You know, a chocolate bar could. I think there's something like 170 milligrams of theobromine and about, between 20 and 30 milligrams of caffeine in a chocolate bar, an average chocolate bar. Chocolate drink, maybe our other guest knows the answer to this. I just don't know how much less of the ingredients of chocolate are in sort of a hot chocolate. But, of course, if you put it in milk, then and there's a little tryptophan in chocolate and you have tryptophan in milk, you actually might have a calming effect of the hot chocolate drink.
And you're nodding your head, Clay.
Well, I think a lot of it is very, very much like a placebo effect. You're expecting the hot chocolate to put you asleep, so it's going to help you. It's going to help put you to sleep. But one thing that I want to respond to what Dr. Kelly said earlier is that whether or not chocolate is an aphrodisiac may depend on what we mean by aphrodisiac. So if by aphrodisiac we mean I'm going to give somebody a substance and it's going to make them want to become intimate with, can I say have sex with me?
Yeah.
If by giving them chocolate is going to make them want to have sex with me when they wouldn't otherwise, then probably not. Chocolate is not an aphrodisiac. But if what you're looking at is a substance which is going to help set the stage and enhance intimacy, then absolutely yes. In that respect, chocolate can be a very, very potent and powerful aphrodisiac.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Hasn't a study shown that heroin addicts have an increased liking for chocolate?
I'm not aware of that specific study. What I do know is that heroin addicts, if they can't get hold of their the drug, heroin or morphine or whatever it might be, that they crave sweets and they substitute. They'll look to substitute and reduce their feelings of dysphoria from the withdrawal with sweets or fats, or including chocolate.
What about some of the other things that people say about chocolate, that it can cause acne, that it brings on headaches, especially migraines?
Well, actually, I was reading recently about that there is no evidence, as far as I know, that chocolate can cause acne. I think that's really an urban legend or an old wives' tale. I don't know if Craig knows about that.
He's agreeing with you.
Yeah.
Excuse me?
No, it's true. I mean, almost everything that we associate as being bad about chocolate has nothing to do with the cocoa content of what you're eating. It has to do with other ingredients.
Sugar,
right. Butter, fat, other things.
That's right.
But, you know, cocoa doesn't cause acne. I suppose if you were predisposed to be sensitive to methylxanthines, that you might get headaches from theobromine and caffeine. But in general, there's also some research, I don't know if you know about this, Dr. Kelly, that suggests that a craving of chocolate might be a prodromal symptom of the onset of a migraine.
Oh, yeah, that definitely could be. And again, it's very individual. Some people, the caffeine-like drugs actually help headache.
Right.
People get a headache when they don't have their coffee. Or whatever they, you know, tea. So I think it's as Craig says, a very individual, depending on the negative effects of chocolate.
What about the people who tell me they're allergic to chocolate? Is there an ingredient that they're reacting to?
Again, in terms of individual response, if there's something in chocolate that doesn't agree with, or someone is allergic to, that definitely could be. I personally don't. I don't know of anyone allergic to chocolate. Most people, in fact, I think that chocolate is really the most craved food, if I'm not mistaken, of all foods. But again, you know, there are some people who don't like chocolate or who have, negative reactions.
And why is it the most craved food? Because of all those stimulant chemicals in it?
Well, you know, chocolate is such a fascinating food because of the combination of the drugs, and getting back to the anandamide, that's not a stimulant. It can be a mild euphoriant, and it can be calming. It can induce feelings of well-being, but calm feelings of well-being in psychoactive doses. So you have a substance which has these relatively mild doses, a number of different compounds that affect the brain, But the fat and sugar together are what I think really, you know, causes that powerful craving punch. I mean, we crave, people crave donuts, ice cream. It doesn't have to have chocolate in it. I mean, there's something about high fat and sweet foods, in particular the combination of fat with sugar, which, you know, brain imaging studies have shown, have in our own studies with looking at genes and gene expression in the brain, have very powerful effects on the emotional reward system in the brain.
Dr. Kelly, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we will be talking to listeners and find out why chocolate seems to be the most studied food of them all. We'll find out if there are any real health benefits from chocolate and find out what our listeners want to know about chocolate. I might even taste a few chocolates here because Clay has brought some. Our on-air number is 212-433-9692. We'll be back after this. And we're back with Dr. Ann E. Kelly, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and with Clay Gordon. He calls himself Chocolate Critic, and his website is chocophile.com. And Clay, you brought in a whole bunch of chocolates. I'm afraid to eat them all because I know acne is just a myth, but I'm still afraid. No, I did try one of them.
Which one was that?
The Amano Artisan Chocolate. It says Akumeyer. Grand Cru. It sounds like a wine.
Yep.
Grand Cru dark chocolate, 70% cacao minimum. And it was extraordinary.
It is. And actually,
I'm almost ready to become an addict.
It's a wonderful story. I mean, one of the things that people say, you know, people who make chocolate in America, they don't know what they're talking about. This is a brand new startup artisan chocolate manufacturer out of Orem, Utah. And what I brought in today is actually his first production. This is his first batch.
Could I make it at home?
As a matter of fact, I'm giving a class on Sunday called How to Make Chocolate in Your Home Kitchen. And you can do it with actually a rather small investment in technology.
Now, I hear that Miller Beer is introducing a chocolate-flavored lager.
They're doing it seasonally. That's correct.
Does that sound like something you would want to try, Dr. Kelly?
I was going to say, it's not fair because I'm not in the studio and I'm getting a chocolate craving just looking at
it. Unfortunately, well, they don't. I mean, I haven't even tasted it yet. I actually went out there last year and it was involved in a panel and, you know, was part of the process of helping them really decide to help market it. And I never actually have had a chance to taste it because it's not released here in New York City. It's only in the upper Midwest around Chicago.
It's interesting. In Madison, in the past few years, there have been a number, at least three or four new sort of artisanal chocolatiers that have started up. It seems to be a new thing that is happening.
Absolutely, and not just artisan chocolatiers, people who make confections, but artisan chocolate manufacturers like Amano. And Grand Cru, I mean, talking about chocolate the way people are talking about wine actually has been very, very good for chocolate. The beans in the bar you tasted, Leonard, come from a single region in Venezuela called Ocumare, right, which is known very, very highly for very, very high-quality cacao. Well, the most interesting chocolate I have there is actually from Amano, and it's the one of beans that come from Madagascar.
Okay, I'll try that in a moment. But I won't tell Dr. Kelly I'm doing it, okay?
No.
Meanwhile, let's take some calls. Our number is 212-433-9692. Tanya from Hazlet, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you, Leonard?
I'm well, Tanya. I'm eating chocolate.
Hold on. I'm sorry, I just dropped the phone.
Uh-huh, baby, you're so excited.
I have two sons who absolutely abhor chocolate from birth, ages 5 and 12. They have never liked it, which I thought was strange. But actually, the 12-year-old will now, every once in a while, eat an M&M. Hmm. But
Do they like sweets in general?
They are the type of kids that would do well at your grandma's house with the hard candy because they're happy with that. Skittles. At Halloween, our friends, the mothers would be very happy to go through their bags because they can eat all their candy. They just don't like it.
Now, Tanya, is there a question here?
I had that statement, and I also had a question. I know they said that about chocolate affecting things. What about in terms of types of things like genital herpes? Because I've had issues with that.
You mean when you've had chocolate?
Yes.
Dr. Kelly?
Well, I've never heard of that link. It's not to say that it doesn't exist, but I certainly am not an expert on that, and I'm not aware of any possible link.
And in the interest of good taste, I won't talk about Valentine's Day and all the connections that are possible.
What I could say, though, is that the genetics of taste is an interesting area, and people, individuals do have different sensitivities to taste. Some people can't even taste certain things. Some people are the super tasters that are hired by the taste manufacturers of artificial flavors and so on, and Robert Parker and his ability with wine. But so it could be that there are some individuals, particularly since both of your children don't like it, that just do not like the particular taste of chocolate.
Now, Clay, I did try that Madagascar chocolate.
Yes.
And I was thinking of wine again because it had a really long finish.
Yes.
And the mouthfeel is something I would talk about, things that I would feel embarrassed to talk about if I were having a Nestle bar.
You know, good chocolate is like, it's an orgasm going off in your mouth. One of the things that I think that people find addictive about chocolate is certainly the mouthfeel. One of the more addictive properties of chocolate is just the way chocolate feels when you put it in your mouth and it melts in your mouth. And the combination of butter and chocolate or cream and chocolate in a ganache, which is the filling in many truffles, mm-hmm. the way it just feels melting in your mouth. Cocoa butter is unlike any other fat in the universe in the way it melts in your mouth, and that's a lot of what people react to.
When did people start coming up with the idea of putting fillings in chocolate?
It depends. If you listen to some of the memoirs of read some of the memoirs of the Marquis de Sade, you'll find that the late 1700s is when people start doing it. But really, modern confections, modern truffles, is the 1850s, 1870s.
Right.
Let's go to Liz from Elizabeth, New Jersey. Hi, Liz. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks. An acquaintance of mine told me she doesn't eat chocolate. She's a highly educated woman. And she said the reason is because there's a lot of lead in chocolate. And she said it comes from the process of growing it. Some of the fuels they use or some of the machines that are around it. She told me to look on the internet, and I did see a few articles, but I don't own my own computer, so I didn't really read them thoroughly. Anyway, have either of you ever heard of this? And do you know if one buys organic chocolate, if that would mitigate this phenomena, if it is true?
I certainly have not heard of that at all. You might get less chemicals if it is organic and when it's grown. Maybe Craig knows more. I don't really know the conditions of how chocolate is grown and manufactured with regard to contaminants.
It's actually, it's potentially true, but it's not nearly as bad as many people make it out to be. Much cacao is grown in volcanic soils, and one of the nature's volcanic soils is they often have heavy metals in them. It turns out that cadmium is more likely to be in cacao than lead.
Well, that's really bad.
That's really bad. But it turns out that many of the more responsible manufacturers actually do soil testing and have done a good job of trying to make sure that the cacao they're bringing into the country is, in fact, does not contain measurable quantities of any of those metals. Also, some cacao is dried on the side of the road in many countries, and so you have diesel buses driving by it, and you can deposit lead on the cacao that way. But in general, it's not as big a problem as people make it out to be.
Cherie from Manhattan. Hi, you're on. Please explain.
Hi, good afternoon. I was wondering if you could explain or talk about the difference between Swiss chocolate and Belgian chocolate.
Or French chocolate, for that matter.
Mm-hmm. The answer to that question is cocoa beans don't grow in Belgium or Switzerland or France or Italy, or in fact many of the places or most of the places where chocolate is made. It turns out that Belgian chocolate is made in Belgium and Swiss chocolate is made in Switzerland and French chocolate is made in France. That's it.
There are styles, aren't there?
There are styles of chocolate. They tend to be a Northern European style, which I classify as Belgian. Which tends to be lighter and sweeter. There's a Southern European style, French and Italian, which is it's a little darker. The difference between, for example, an espresso and a cafe latte. All right, so those are the differences. There's an American style, which is just over the top and very sweet as well. But when we talk about Belgian and French and Swiss, we're talking about the country in which the chocolate is manufactured.
Now we're starting to see chocolate being used in cooking in general. And Sicily has had a long tradition of making, putting chocolate into dishes. I think they really embrace the new world and make a turkey dish with some chocolate in the sauce. Mm-hmm. So chocolate is more than just a dessert.
Chocolate's been, well, it actually, the Spanish conquered the Caribbean, to some extent Central America, looking for gold, but also they transplanted sugar from India. It turns out it's the Spanish who had the sweet tooth, not the Mesoamericans, not the Aztecs and the Incas and the Mayas.
They used to put chili in theirs.
Chili and vanilla, which is a product of the New World as well. And so, for example, if you were to look at a traditional Mexican dish, a mole poblano, mole is just another word for mixture. And so there's a mole rojo, which is a red, and then a mole amarillo, a mole verde. It turns out that the mole poblano, if you look at the ingredients, more than half of them don't originate in the New World. So what we think of as a traditional Mexican dish actually has a lot of its roots back in Europe.
It's a fusion dish, like...
Yes, very, very much a
and
Creole...
And Europe, of course, fusion, because there were no tomatoes before Columbus. There were no peppers. There were no chilies.
No potatoes.
No potatoes, no...
Vanilla.
Vanilla, no chocolate.
That's right.
Boy, Europe must have been a terrible place before 1492. George from the Upper West Side. Hi, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Leonard. Two things. First of all, the Scharfenberger from Scharfenberger Chocolates gives a wonderful talk from time to time at the New School, which I highly recommend to anybody. It's completely changed the way I eat chocolate and look at chocolate. One of the things that he's done is to bring pure pieces, as pure as one can get, for us to taste. We could see, for example, in the Ivory Coast, when the war was going on there, you could even taste the burning from the roofs as they tried to cure their beans before invading armies stole them. Which affected what many of the European chocolates tasted like. You could even tell year by year what a difference it was. I've become a dark chocolate eater. The main reason that I call, however, is that chocolate, as from a chemical perspective, is considered the perfect oxalate. And as such, for people who form, I think it's called calcium kidney stones or oxalate stones, they can't eat chocolates. And it's something that's often overlooked.
You haven't studied that. Even though people are studying chocolate more than any other food, we still have a lot of mysteries?
I think there are a lot of mysteries. For one thing, as I was doing some of my research of my own, I was surprised at how few studies there were, actually, on chocolate, at least chocolate in the brain and chocolate in the reinforcing effects. I was a bit surprised by that. I think that there still are mysteries because, for one thing, it's such a complex food. There's so much in it. So when you do scientific studies on chocolate in the brain or on mood or on feelings, if you want to really figure out what is it that's causing an effect, let's say you give research subjects chocolate and you do a study on mood, is it the cocoa butter? Is it just the fat? Is it the sugar? Is it the drugs that are the psychoactive drugs that are in it? And sometimes studies try to parse these things out, but most often than not, they don't. So there's a lot of mystery left in trying to figure out. But, it could be that it's the combination. That would be my belief, in mm-hmm. fact, is that you never really would get to the point. There's been lots of studies on tryptophan and mood and lots of studies on THC and anandamide marijuana-like compounds. But really, it's the combination of the compounds and the texture, as Craig was saying earlier, is key for the brain. There's been some wonderful studies looking at the response of the brain in imaging to different textures with different fat textures. And very specific reward-like areas light up when people, experience fat, certain kinds of fat in their mouth.
Now, why do dogs want chocolate so much, and why have I been warned not to let them?
Well, I think it's the same thing as dogs love fat. Fat is a cue. It's an immediate cue to the mouth taste sensors that it's high calorie and that it's good. Because normally, in ancient times, high calorie food was very good to eat a lot of and fast. So they love that. But theobromine can be very toxic to dogs. It can, you know, be a high dose stimulant. They're very sensitive to it for some reason, and it really can be quite dangerous in some dogs.
Cats as well, Clay?
Some people will say that their cats are sensitive to theobromine. I've not seen any research that suggests it, but basically, dogs that eat enough theobromine, their metabolism speeds up and they hyperventilate themselves or go into cardiac arrest.
Now, of course, cats don't eat everything, whereas dogs will eat anything that is
right.
That has been left out.
Yeah, cats don't have sweet receptors, for example, so most cats won't be interested in sweets at all, whereas dogs do.
Andy from New Brunswick, hi, you're on. Please explain.
Hey, thanks a lot, Leonard. Listen, the reason I called was earlier in the show, I believe the professor mentioned that she didn't really know too many people who were allergic to chocolate. And, in fact, actually, my mother is severely allergic to chocolate.
What happens when she eats chocolate?
Well, what happens is actually she'll break out in hives and, you know, kind of a typical allergic reaction that you'd get from maybe something else. And the interesting thing is she was never allergic to chocolate her whole entire life. And then about 10 years ago, she just one day she had an allergic reaction. She didn't know what it was, and after some research, she found out that it was actually the chocolate. So I was wondering, A, what would cause an allergic reaction like that, and B, how could you go from not being allergic to it your entire life to suddenly being allergic to it?
Well, certainly the second question is easier to answer in the sense that that's very common. For example, I became severely allergic to penicillin in my 40s. I mean. And who knows why that happened. That's a really complex effect that I don't think people, you know, really understand. And what it is in the chocolate, you know, that I really don't know. This is not really my field of you know, expertise. But
well, I have a producer who says that she has a bad reaction to dark chocolate, but not to milk chocolate.
Huh.
Maybe it's the concentration of cocoa powder.
It could be that there's a sensitivity to one of the chemicals. You'd have to go and say, what kind of chocolate are you eating?
Right.
And really understand. I mean, for example, we talked about lead uptake or cadmium uptake in some cocoa. So it may be that some beans grown in some regions have trace components of something that you're allergic to. It also turns out that, you know, unfortunately, there are trace amounts of mycotoxins, funguses, which exist on the outside of the cocoa bean.
That's right.
So it could be that those, because the beans aren't sanitized or roasted fully, that those get into the chocolate, and you're actually not reacting to the cocoa, but something which is in the chocolate, should not be there to begin with.
Right.
Okay, thank you for calling us. A number of listeners are concerned about slave labor being used or child labor being used in the production of cocoa beans, and in the same way that we've heard about problems with coffee beans.
Right. Well, it's a very difficult thing to document. There are over 600,000 smallholder farms in the country of the Ivory Coast alone, and slave labor or indentured servitude has probably been demonstrated to occur on less than 0.01% of those farms. Any amount of it is, you know, unconscionable. But at the same token, I think what we need to also take a look at is, you know, let's look at the American farm. How many children grow up in American farms? They're abused by their parents. They're forced to work an enormous amount. Again, they're not paid. They're all these kinds of things. To go to a foreign country and try to hold them to a different standard than we hold ourselves to is something we also need to look at as well.
Should we take another call? I think we could sneak one more call in here. This is from... Who is this? Imgard? Is that your name?
Yes.
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Love your show. Very interesting. I just wanted to say, I read the other day in a medical magazine about women before they menstruate, how a certain level falls, and that's when they crave chocolate, and it is really, it was, in my life, it was always like that. I couldn't believe it. I wanted to say about the guilt that's associated in many women with eating chocolate because it gained weight. And the other thing I wanted to say was, I read the other day on Yahoo, they are making chocolates now for Valentine's Day, and there was one chocolate, it was being rated, and there was one that sold between $90 and $120 a pound, and I just thought that was a little bit I don't know what to call it, to buy chocolate for $100 a pound.
I guess if you can afford it, then you do it. But does that... Have you heard about that, Clay?
Well, absolutely. Chocolate is one of the most affordable gourmet foods that there are. I mean, if you're into, you know, aged balsamic vinegar, I mean, a good 75-year-old, you know, balsamic vinegar can cost you the equivalent of $2,000 a liter. People will spend $300 for a, or $600 for a, you know, a half bottle of Chateau de Chem to suggest that extremely good chocolate doesn't belong or doesn't even deserve to belong in that price range is I think an attitude and a mindset that I and other people are trying to change.
Now, Dr. Kelly, if it's true that women, or some women anyway, crave chocolate before they menstruate, does that mean that menopause eliminates that craving?
I don't think so. But, you know, I mean, chocolate has been shown to have, you know, positive effects on mood and anti-anxiety effects. And so if there, because of hormonal changes during the menstrual cycle, there are times when one feels more anxious or tense, there is no question. In fact, it has been studied. I remember one study comparing a chocolate bar with an apple in women, actually, in normal weight women. And it had very measurable effects on their mood. But interestingly, as the caller says, not only was joy increased, there were self-ratings, but also guilt. And there's something, this is a cultural thing too, but, you know, there's so much guilt, almost a guilty pleasure. You know, it's both joy and guilt can be induced by chocolate at the same time.
And you've convinced us that once we take the sugar out and some of the other bad things, that the chocolate is actually pretty good for us.
Well, that's the other important thing to remember is that, in fact, lately there's been quite a lot of research on health benefits of chocolate, and there are some very interesting studies that it has powerful, you know, the flavonoids in chocolate have antioxidant properties. They're beneficial for cardiac health, such as lowering blood pressure and lowering stickiness of blood and lowering blood platelets.
Which, ironically, can actually have ameliorating effects on diabetes symptoms.
Interesting.
We have to leave it there, unfortunately.
Right.
But thank you both so much.
Thank
you so much, both of you, for participating in Please Explain today. I've been talking with Dr. Anne E. Kelly, professor of psychiatry at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and with Clay Gordon, the chocolate critic whose website is chocophile.com.
Thank you.